Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. The Coffee Clatch and Special Needs Talk Radio Network feature outstanding programming for the special needs community. Our team of hosts provide educational interviews. Our shows are not designed to provide listeners with specific or personal medical, legal, or professional service or advice. Parents of children with health issues should always consult their health care provider for medical advice, medications, or treatment. Any show discussing rights and law for special needs children and special education are presented as general information and not legal advice. Special Needs Coffee Clatch Limited does not promote any host or guest individual practice, programs, treatments, or products. We thank you for joining us and are proud to provide excellence in broadcasting for the special needs community. And now, on to the interview.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clatch. This is Marianne Russo. Tonight we have a really special show for you. We're going to be discussing a topic that is very near and dear to my heart, a disorder that my daughter has. I've spoken about many times on the show. And we're featuring a film that is being made that is really going to change lives. The film is Canary in a Coal Mine, and it follows the lives of several really remarkable people living with myalgic encephalomyelitis. It's a very mysterious and devastating disease. These people are forced to leave their jobs that they've loved, their dreams of what they thought their future would be. It puts a strain on their lives, their relationships, really every aspect of their lives. And what it really is about is the human consequence of a medical system that is ill-equipped to treat an illness that challenges its every assumption, the danger of ignorance and the power of a name. It's the story of a community of millions that to most of the world are invisible. And we have several guests. We have Jennifer Bray, who's going to be on later. She is the director and producer of this film. We have a remarkable woman from the United Kingdom, Jessica Taylor. She's going to be joining us in a little while. But right now, we are honored to be starting off with Dr. Derek Enlander. Dr. Enlander is considered one of the most renowned experts on fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and ME in the world. He has a fibromyalgia chronic fatigue center in Manhattan. He was the physician-in-waiting to the British royal family during their visits here to New York. And he is on the faculty of Mount Sinai Medical School and is an attending physician at Mount Sinai Medical Center. As I said, we're honored to have you on the show, Dr. Enlander.
It's my honor, indeed.
I will never forget, on a personal note, the first time I brought my daughter to see you. She had been suffering terribly for many years and was either dismissed or passed along by all of the specialists, the dozens that we'd seen. And after you looked at her history, you looked at her blood work, you looked at her brain scans, you said something that changed the course of her journey. And what you said was, Aliana, I want you to know you are not crazy. You have chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, and it is real. It is a physical disease. And that validation is what it gave her such enduring hope. It gave her confirmation of everything she had gone through, and I want to thank you for that. I'm sure that you hear that from many patients that come to see you.
I remember Aliana very well. I remember actually examining her, and I remember actually going through copious notes. The problem in this disease is, as I actually have said in Jennifer's brilliant film, that a lot of doctors are arrogant, and this arrogance actually goes to saying that if we, as the medical profession, cannot make a diagnosis, the patient must be wrong, instead of actually saying, well, maybe we just don't have enough information, or maybe we haven't done the right tests.
Right.
In the case of myalgic encephalomyelitis, called in America chronic fatigue syndrome, we actually tend to not understand this disease because we don't know exactly the cause. We believe actually that the cause is an immune system dysfunction, perhaps caused by a prior exposure to a virus. Melvin Ramsey, the brilliant clinician from the Royal Free Hospital in London, wrote his thesis on this disease. It's not actually a recent phenomenon. This disease actually has been around for half a century.
Yeah.
And when Melvin actually discovered actually a cohort of young doctors and nurses in the Royal Free Hospital suffering from this disease, the young doctors and nurses were told that they were hysterical, and perhaps actually Melvin Ramsey was also hysterical for making the diagnosis. Doctors actually said, well, all the normal blood tests are normal, which indeed is true.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the right blood tests were looked at or that the right blood tests were available at that particular time in 1955. So the arrogance, unfortunately, is still is pervasive. A lot of doctors actually tell the patients, well, you're depressed. Go and see a psychiatrist. Or there's nothing wrong with you. You're imagining it.
You know, actually, my daughter's pediatrician had said to her after, I mean, and when I say this, I mean this literally, after bringing her to the doctor to see her every week for months, you know, just turned around to her and said, suck it up. You're 13 years old. Go out with your friends, start having fun, and stop complaining to your mother. And it was the most disturbing thing that somebody could say to someone that's suffering like this. But, you know, I want to go into with you exactly what this is, chronic fatigue syndrome and myalgic encephalomyelitis. You know, are they the same disorder and just used interchangeably? And are there subgroups within this umbrella of chronic fatigue syndrome? And how would a doctor make a diagnosis?
We're treading on, actually, thin ice. There are people, actually, who think that ME, myalgic encephalomyelitis, and CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, are two separate and distinct problems. That may well be that there are actually variations in this disease. There are variations in many diseases. There are variations in, well, let me take something completely non-connected. Let me take a condition called tuberculosis of the lung. Tuberculosis of the lung actually can be a devastating lethal disease, and yet there can be actually patients who have a relatively light infection and actually carry on what we might term a normal life. So there are variations in tuberculosis. There may well be also variations in this disease. As we well know, Jennifer actually, who made the film, is more or less bedridden by this disease, and yet we have other patients who are affected by this disease but can actually perform somewhat in their education or in their career. Other patients actually have had their careers cut short by this disease. It's a terrible affliction.
Right. And do you find that, you know, I would assume that someone could get the same virus as, like, say, my daughter or Jennifer and not, you know, wind up having chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia or ME. So is there some type, are you finding any type of predisposition, any type of genetic link to it? I know that you were looking into that.
Well, the first part of your question is, other actually people who are exposed to some of these viruses, and the five viruses actually that are actually most often mentioned are HHV6, human herpes virus 6, not to be confused with sexual herpes, Coxsackie B, which was the virus that Melvin Ramsey first described in his 1955 case write-up, cytomegalo inclusion virus, retrovirus. Now, the retrovirus story is somewhat cloudy because actually my friend Judy Mikovits who actually did the original research on XMRV virus and wrote it up in Science Journal, and it was unfortunately had to be retracted because it was found to be not a causative agent, but to be an agent that had been transferred from one lab to another.
Okay.
Epstein-Barr virus, and a virus actually at my friend Jonathan Kerr, who unfortunately did work, signal work at St. George's Hospital in London, and unfortunately he had to actually withdraw from ME-CFS research because he didn't get tenure. Parvo 19. So any of these viruses actually have been connected with this disease. Now, the unfortunate thing is that these all are common viruses. So the problem with a common virus is that everybody's exposed to these common viruses.
Right.
So if we actually say that these viruses are causing this disease, detractors will say, well, everybody actually has been exposed to these viruses, so why doesn't everybody have this disease? And obviously only 1% of the population has this disease. So the question is, well, if there is a relationship, why are the patients suffering? And why is the rest of the population, 98-99% of the population, not? And the answer is exactly what you said. Maybe there is a genetic predisposition. With that in mind, we actually were given $1 million, actually, to set up a ME-CFS center by one of my patients, who very generously actually gave me this generous grant. And we set up a group, including actually a world-famous geneticist, Eric Schacht. And Eric actually became very enthused about trying to find actually its genetic predisposition. And we are indeed actually working along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to really, I would assume, be so important. When you're making this diagnosis, you know, fibromyalgia is a subjective type of a diagnosis with trigger points, and, you know, there's really no definitive blood work. But I remember from the testing you did on my daughter that, you know, there are results of tests that can lead you to this diagnosis. Am I correct?
Well, what we have found, actually, Nancy Klimas, actually, who is also actually in Jennifer's film, is an immunologist, and she has found, actually, that there are immunological deficits in this disease. For example, actually, certain cytokines, actually, are abnormal. Natural killer cells are reduced. Natural killer cell function is reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And certain other immunological markers are a problem. Classically, we have actually added to the old Fukuda criteria the new criteria, which includes post-exertional malaise, which seems to actually be somewhat peculiar to this disease. That means actually after a patient has done some exertion, 24, 36, or 72 hours later, they actually are suffering from a malaise due to this exertion. So therefore, it's not an anaerobic or aerobic problem, because that would actually occur immediately after the exertion. This is, we believe, some reflection of an immune system dysfunction.
Yeah, you know, my other daughter has PANDAS, so, and, you know, so many other parents that I speak to that have children with this, their other children seem to have some type of a compromised immune system, so, you know, there has to be something, and I'm glad you're looking for it. You know, these disorders, or diseases, they have such a neurological component to it as well, a lot of sensory issues, a lot of emotional presentations. Why do you think it is that it encompasses so many areas of someone's life?
Now let's return to Melvin Ramsey. Melvin Ramsey actually was practicing in the 1950s. In the 1950s, we didn't have actually the benefits which we have today of CAT scans, MRIs, SPECTs, PETs, functional MRIs. We didn't have all these scanning mechanisms to determine where the actual abnormality lay and what the actual deficits were. And he actually made the diagnosis a term myalgic encephalomyelitis, myalgic being actually a function of abnormality in muscle, encephalo being involving the brain, and myelitis actually involving actually peripheral nerves. So therefore, he conjured ME as a term, a new term, involving actually the brain without actually, as I said, having these scanning mechanisms. Absolutely brilliant. So if we accept that this, and everybody I think does accept, that there are implications in the central nervous system, that the brain is afflicted, the affliction in the brain can actually be universal throughout the body, because the brain is obviously encompassing many, many functional problems.
And you use multiple approaches, which I was very impressed with. You use a lot of different approaches for your patients. So can you tell us what you're doing and why you're doing them?
Well, we're doing them actually not because of any sort of clever diagnostic. Really have got no pinpoint that method of diagnosing this disease. What we've got to do is we've got to rule out other possibilities which cause the symptoms. There are many diseases which cause fatigue and fatigue-like illnesses, simple diseases and more complex diseases. Simple diseases such as anemia. Anemia actually, iron deficiency anemia, will actually produce a fatigue-like illness. More complex diseases such as leukemia, lupus, multiple sclerosis can also produce a confusing consortium of symptoms which can and do mimic the symptoms that we see. So we've got to rule out these diseases before we come up with a diagnosis of ME/CFS.
Right. Well, you know, I think one of the problems we have is the lack of research, you know, and I'm hoping that that's going to change soon. But, you know, if there's someone out there that, you know, is suffering with this and isn't being, you know, listened to, you know, what recommendation would you have to them to go to get to somebody to help them?
Well, you've got to find actually a doctor actually who is sympathetic, first of all. Mm-hmm. You're going to actually have a doctor who's going to tell you suck it in, or whatever the answer is actually told.
Right.
That's obviously, you're not going to get very far, because the doctor already has made a decision that there's nothing wrong with the patient and the patient is imagining it. So you've got to actually say to the doctor, well, do you realize that the patient is sick? And the doctor says, no, I don't accept that the patient is sick. Well, obviously one has to go elsewhere. The problem in this disease is that there is depression. There's depression in lots of chronic diseases. There's depression in cancer. A patient actually has cancer. They're depressed. They're suffering from a disease actually, which is going to afflict their life or has afflicted their life, and there's a long sort of road ahead of them. They're depressed because they're not able to do the things that they want to do and that they used to be able to do. So they're depressed. Now, nobody in their right mind is going to say, oh, your depression has caused cancer.
Right.
However, in ME/CFS, they are also depressed because they actually are now afflicted by a condition which has changed their manner of life. And doctors have got no problem in saying, oh, you're depressed. The depression has caused your condition, not that the ME/CFS has caused the depression.
It's absolutely mind-boggling. It really is. Well, Dr. Enlinger, I want to thank you for joining us. You know, speaking of severe cases and someone who wasn't listened to, I'm going to be bringing on Jessica Taylor. I'm sorry.
I just would like to actually say one final thing. Mm-hmm. And that is that the MECFS Center at Sinai, that this generous donor actually set up, is having actually a second conference in November the 20th, to which all patients actually are invited. And we will actually have Nancy Klimas and Dan Peterson, Eric Schacht, speaking on
wow.
the disease. And we actually would like to see actually anybody who is in the vicinity to come.
It's oh, well, I'm definitely going to put that...
We'll be held at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York.
Well, I'm definitely going to call your office, get the information, and we'll be putting that on this on the interview blog. So thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure. It's my honor and pleasure. Thank you
thank
very,
you.
Very much. Bye-bye.
I'm going to be bringing on now... an extraordinary woman, Jessica Taylor. She's 21 years old. She lives in the United Kingdom, and she was about to embark into her adult life and independent living when her life took a very different turn. In 2006, everything changed for Jessica. She developed a very severe form of myalgic encephalomyelitis and chronic fatigue syndrome, which by the end of the year had rendered her completely bedbound. She spent 4 continuous years in the hospital due to the severity of the condition, and she's been in and out of the hospital since. I want to read you a little bit of something that I found on her blog. And she wrote, "This new life has definitely been somewhat of a roller coaster, to say the least, as I've struggled tremendously not only with my physical condition but the general lack of understanding and knowledge that seemingly comes with it. There have been various dips and turns within my illness. At the worst times, I remained unable to move or speak. I still am severely unwell. Since this biography was first written, I have suffered a great number of added knocks, but my general positivity and great love for life, alongside my sense of humor, despite the odds, has strengthened me in my fight to get better, for I truly believe in a future beyond this." As I said, Jessica Taylor is just extraordinary, so I am going to bring her on now. Jessica, are you here? Jessica? Let me try to bring her on. Just 1 second, everyone. I think I might have had a little connection problem. I am going to try to bring her back on, if everybody can just... be patient for 1 second. International calling with Blog Talk Radio isn't always so easy, but I'll bring her right back on.
Hi there.
Hi, Jessica. I'm sorry we lost you there for a second. It's Marianne. We're on the air, and I just, I don't know if you heard, I was reading a little bit from your blog and telling them a little bit about you, but now I want you to really just speak to the listeners, and, if you'd like, I'd like you to just start off by talking about, you have an extremely severe case of ME. So can you tell us how it started and how old you were when it started? We're having a technical problem with the Skype with Jessica. I'm going to bring her back on. I'm going to have Chuck try to straighten that out. But right now I'm going to bring on Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer. How are you? Hi, Jennifer. I'm sorry. We're having some technical problems with the international call. How are you?
No problem at all. I'm great. How are you doing, Marianne?
I'm good. Well, we're going to get Jessica back on and hear her story. But you are... unbelievable. I met you the other night. You are the producer and the director of this film, Canary in a Coal Mine. And I just wanted to let the audience know who you are. You were a doctoral student in the Department of Government at Harvard University. You are now on medical leave. And prior to that, you were a print journalist in Beijing, East Africa. And you've earned your AB in politics from Princeton University. And your story is just unbelievable. You were signing a check at a restaurant when you found that you could not write your own name. And this was months before your wedding, and you became progressively more ill, losing the ability to even sit in a wheelchair. I mean, this is devastating. Tell us a little bit about how this happened. because, I mean, I think that nobody, like you say in the trailer, it is so crazy, this disorder, that nobody could believe it.
Yeah, well, I didn't believe it either as it was happening to me. It was a little bit unbelievable. I mean, basically what happened is a year before, so the check in the restaurant moment was my first neurological symptom. But a year before that, I had come down with the worst fever of my life. My temperature was like 104.7 degrees, and it held for 5 days until it went down to 102. And I had a 10-day fever, which has never happened in my life.
Right.
And after the fever, I became extremely dizzy and, had to sort of hug the wall to make it to the bathroom. And I had to lay in bed, and I couldn't leave my house for, I think, about 2 weeks. And I went to the doctor and was examined, and they said, oh, you have an inner ear infection, was their conclusion, and sent me home and said I would be better in a few days. And then a few weeks later, I had a sore throat, and then that lasted for 2 days, and then once that was over, I was dizzy again, and it kept happening. These sort of, whether my illness lasted for a few days or for a week, once the sort of normal sinus infection, sore throat was over, I would have, like, this extreme dizziness. And for the first year, I kept going to my doctor, and I kept saying, I think there's something wrong with my immune system. And he said, oh, that's impossible. If there was something wrong with your immune system, it would have been wrong since you were a child. Every possible explanation that I would give to him of, like, I think something is wrong, here's what I'm seeing, and there's a pattern, he kept ignoring, because the pattern was there, but it wasn't the pattern that he had been trained to see in medical school. And so, I had stretches of time when I was actually completely well during the first year, and then I was at this restaurant, and the check came, and I couldn't find my name. And it was a bizarre experience if you never had it before, and I'm kind of used to it now. But I was looking at the check. I was thinking of my name. I was imagining myself drawing gold that is, a part of the first letter J, and I could not move my hand. And it took me a while to realize that I had actually just lost the ability to draw curves, and I could not write, J's or C's or, the second part of the letter D. And this sort of progressed into what I was diagnosed with ER with, which was a, complex migraine or an atypical migraine. And so to make a long story short, I finally ended up at a neurologist, and he sort of said, okay, well, maybe you're having epilepsy, epileptic episodes, maybe you're a migraine neuro who's just sort of come into her own. And he ruled those out, and the third option was that I had conversion disorder, which he explained to me as a sort of, physical symptoms that felt very real, but that were being produced by some unconscious, stress or repressed trauma. And I thought, that is such a strange explanation, but, I was, doing a master's in stats, and I was sort of being trained in scientific thinking, and so I thought, okay, like, I don't want to reject this hypothesis out of hand. Let me compare it to sort of the data that I have and sort of think about it for a while. And so, I asked him, was the sinus infection that I had last year, after which I was dizzy for 3 weeks, and for which I took antibiotics, is that psychosomatic? Is the pain that I'm feeling right now in my leg psychosomatic? And he said yes. So I walked home with my husband from the medical clinic and back to my house, and I was at a mile and, kind of meditating on the psychosomatic pain in my legs. And when I got home, I just collapsed, and my brain and my spinal cord were burning, and
right.
I had a fever. I mean, I had never been aware that I had a spinal cord until this day. It was the strangest feeling, and it was excruciatingly painful. I couldn't walk. I could not move. When I would walk, I could not move one foot in front of the other more than about an inch apart, because I just had lost all mobility. And so And from that time, I mean, I've basically never been as well as I was the day that I was in the office and it was diagnosed with conversion disorder. And I think that, you know, he didn't tell me to exercise, which is what a lot of, which is the advice that a lot of people get. But I think if he told me in that moment, you have myalgic encephalomyelitis, what you really need is complete bed rest. That is your best chance of recovery. I think I would be in a very different situation than I'm in right now. And that's a large part of why I'm making this film. I think no one has to get this bad. And
exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's one of the, you know, you go with my daughter. I brought her to, I'm not even going to mention who, but one of the best palliative care doctors who's supposed to specialize in this in teens, and they wanted her to do a boot camp, aerobics every day. And I'm left there saying, are these people out of their minds? She can't walk. Did you see her? We had to practically carry her in the door. They don't get it. You know, and I'm glad we didn't listen because I hear so many horror stories like yours. But as you said, you know, this, you're passionate about this, making this film. I'm passionate about getting the word out about this film. But one of the ways that this started, and we're going to go a little bit more into, you know, really what your life is now. You know, why don't we do that first? Why don't you tell us a little bit about your life before you got ill? And the impact that, you know, when everything changed.
I'm sorry, so sort of what my life was like before I became ill?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a little bit what you were saying. I mean, I was a very, I always hesitate to say this because there are these sort of stereotypes. This is how you know that the world is wrong. The two most predominant stereotypes of people who get this is that they are hard-driving overachievers and that they are people who are inordinately lazy, you can't get it together. and I'm not sure how both can be true. But I was a very ambitious person, and I think I always dreamed of doing something with my life that would be meaningful and useful to others. And I didn't even really know what that meant, but I just had this belief that that was what I was supposed to do because I had, you know, a hard life when I was a kid, and I have been incredibly lucky in my life, and I wanted to sort of share that in some way. And so I decided that I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be a journalist, and I traveled the world. I was in Beijing for a few years, although I kept getting called to other places. It was sort of Beijing was my home base, and I spent some time in India and in East Africa, and, I actually wonder what role that played in predisposing me to this, and as much as I had the sort of, I breathed the fiberglass and the sort of toxic chemicals and, all of that crap in the air in Beijing, and I was exposed to all kinds of, microbes because I just traveled everywhere and I ate everything and I did everything and I lived life to the fullest. And when I came back to the U.S., I went to school at Harvard, and so I was in Boston, and there were some signs of some, I knew that I found that I was gluten intolerant and I started taking care of myself better or trying to. But I think that by the time I was hit with this virus, I probably wasn't in the best physical health. I don't think that I knew it because I think from the outside I was just, I was still this sort of young 28-year-old who, is in really good health. But now that I know what I know about what is conducive mm-hmm. to good health, I think I probably wasn't.
Right.
In terms of my life now, I mean, it was a real shock. I think, it's the sort of thing where you have no idea what's going on with you. Your doctors, the ones that you're seeing until you see specialists, have no idea what's happening. And so I think at first I didn't know how long run this would be.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that it was serious.
Right.
And
right.
It was actually, I have to say, for the first few months after the neurological symptoms started, I was very often in a state where I wasn't able to speak and I couldn't use language.
Yes.
I could understand language, but I couldn't speak. I had no verbal thoughts. And when you don't have any verbal thoughts, you can't really think about the past or conceive of the future. You can't
really. That's really interesting.
It was actually a blessing. Because
I would imagine.
I think if I had been more cognitively capable, I would have worried more. But
that's really that's really amazing, because the same thing happened to my daughter. I mean, it was an effort for her just to talk. You know, and that's a message I really want to get out, because this is, you know, this was some at one point, I don't know, maybe a decade ago, considered the yuppie virus. And it is just so obnoxious and offensive to anyone that has this, because this is just so life-changing. You know, and really what I want to go into is this film, because this is life-changing for you and it's going to be life-changing for everyone else. But the way this film started was because of your, you know, the severity of your symptoms. You started keeping a video diary because you said you lost the ability to write. So what was it that caused you to lose the ability to write? Was it that it prohibited you from physically writing, you know, cramping? Was it the brain fog that comes with it, word retrieval? I know word retrieval is a big problem. The exhaustion. You know, what prompted you to start doing a video diary?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because as I was thinking about it, it's like, well, actually, all of the above, depending on the day.
Right.
I mean, so I think that, you know, there were moments when I really just completely lost my use of language completely, and then there were moments where I couldn't even move, and those are sort of the more severe symptoms. I think on a day-to-day basis, I was in a state at the beginning where I could not write for more than sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes 10 words without experiencing this extreme exhaustion. And by exhaustion, the thing about this illness is that there are no words. Like, we use these words, you know, I'm exhausted, I'm fatigued, I'm, like, which describe normal, healthy experiences to this illness. Every symptom I've experienced, I've never experienced before in my life. It feels completely different, and because, you know, most other people don't experience them, there are no common words that we can use to describe them. And I think that's a lot of the failing, which is part of the reason why I think images can be so powerful. But what would happen, and back to your question, what happened was that I would, you know, I would just be typing a little bit on my computer, trying to write a really simple email, and all of a sudden I would not be able to continue. I would feel, you know, what I kind of think is a sort of, you know, an inflammatory response starting in my body because I was typing too much, because I was thinking too hard. I mean, that's how depleted I was of all of my resources. And when things got a little bit better, I could type for longer, but then I would look back at what I was writing, and it would be, you know, I would think that I had written something cogent, and I would switch words that didn't even sound alike. They'd be completely unrelated to each other, and I would make all kinds of mistakes, and I still do, and it's incredibly frustrating because, you know, I used to have a really, you know, good command of language. I loved writing, and I was, you know, working on a book, and have always wanted to be a writer, and so that was really, really disappointing to me. And I think I really struggled for a while to sort of figure out how would I still be myself when I lost something that was so central to my identity.
Well, you know what, I just, you know, when as you're saying this, you know, I just want to say, you know, I have a daughter your age, and, you know, really, you know, I feel for you. And, you know, sometimes when you lose what you thought was your direction, your dream in life, you know, you find that your truth, path, and purpose, you know, it's bigger than what could have ever been when you go through some type of, you know, adversity like this. So, you know, I hope you know that. And, you know, when you talk about powerful, I was shaking at the Kickstarter party the other night. I was literally, my body was shaking as I watched the trailer, because it is so powerful. And I've watched a lot of videos and a lot of things on YouTube, and there is nothing like what you are putting out there, because you are putting out there the reality of how this disorder consumes people. And it's just incredible. And, you know, we're going to go into in a little while. I want you to talk about some of the people that are there. But, you know, I would also assume, I mean, I met your husband. He's adorable at the party the other night. But, you know, how do you deal with the emotional aspect of this? I mean, the physical part of it is just beyond, like you said. You know, and my daughter was very young, and she would even say, I can't even explain to you what it feels like because I don't think anybody's ever felt this before. Physical symptoms. But, you know, the emotional impact that it takes, you know, how did you deal with that? How did your husband, how do you deal with it?
I just want to say first that I really feel for your daughter. And when you sort of tell me a quote like that, I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's my life, too. You know, and that's part of what this experience has been. I think this is why we've been able to raise so much of our goal so quickly on Kickstarter. It's because I think people see themselves in the film, and just as I did as I was sitting in the interview room talking to people in the film and realizing I am not alone, and this is actually a really common experience. In a doctor's office, I'm made to feel like I'm weird or that something is, you know, really far, I'm somehow outside of the bounds, right? But, like, this is actually very not common, but not uncommon, and I want to kind of try to write us back into the story. My husband is amazing, and I think have really grown, especially in the process of sort of listening to other stories, to understand just how lucky I am and to have that support, because I think that family support and the support of a partner, or of a mother or of a sister is the most important thing in this illness, and not everyone has that.
Right.
And, I mean, I think in terms of the emotional aspect, I mean, he's just sort of by nature, and in terms of his personality, a very upbeat person. He loves making jokes. I think he likes being married to me in part because I laugh at his jokes. And so no matter how physically bad I'm feeling or how down I am, he's there, and we create joy together, you know, whether...
You really do.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, and I think we're both people who love adventure, and so we kind of treated this as another great adventure. And so it's also this feeling I can't even describe how close you grow to a person when you go through something like this. And we were engaged to be married, and I kept telling him, are you really sure you still want to do this? I don't know if I'm going to get better. Like,
right.
You don't have to do this. And I went through a very long period where I felt guilty because I still do to some extent, because I wish that we could be, like, you know, traveling the world together and going out with our friends, or like even going out to a restaurant down the road, which is so far from my life.
Right.
But at the same time, we find a way to make our own joy. And
you've taken on this journey together. I mean, he is right by your side with this film. It's a beautiful thing to watch. I think one of the problems that I think you face, my daughter faces, and Jessica, if I can't get her on now, I'm going to have her come on when I have Hillary Johnson come on.
That would be great.
But I think one of the problems is that the term is thrown around so loosely, oh, I have chronic fatigue syndrome, and they might have maybe a very mild case of it, that people that have the ME, I mean, it's like two different worlds. I mean, when you travel, you pack as if you're going away for a week to go into Manhattan, an hour drive. With what you have to bring, and you need a wheelchair, and you need a cot, and it's just when I look at how it has affected your life, and you know how you're still finding the strength to do this, it's just unbelievable. One of the things about this disorder is that it seems to really be very gender related. I mean, I know there are men that get it, but there seems to be more women, or maybe women just present differently. Do you know what the difference is between the men and the women?
There's actually another person you may have on at some point is Mady Hornick, who can tell you about that, because they're doing a study at Columbia, and I think that they may have found something interesting there.
And
oh,
I'm not going to say anything more.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's public or not yet or not. But I think,
okay.
I think that there are definitely these really deep gender differences, and I think that it would be very interesting, not just for this illness, but for a wide range of autoimmune or illnesses of immune dysfunction where you have this sort of 80-20 or 75-25 spread, women-men, that you find in ME is, I think, the same as you find in MS, and it's the same as in a number of other diseases that disproportionately affect women. And so I don't know that that angle has been exploited enough in terms of research. I've also been a little bit perplexed that this hasn't been more, and not to exclude the men at all, but why this hasn't been more of a women's health issue or a women's rights issue.
Absolutely.
As much as my perception is that women's health advocacy groups tend to take a very literal interpretation of what women's health means. So it's about, like, breasts and ovaries, which are really important, as we all know. But what makes women different from men is a lot more than the sort of very obvious anatomical differences. And, you know, I mean, our immune systems are different, right? Because we have to be able to have children. We have to be able to silence or suppress certain aspects of our immunity or alter it in order to be able to carry a child to term and not attack the fetus. And so this is not remotely my area of expertise, but it's a question that I have. It's something that I do wonder about. In terms of verity things, you know, I don't think that everyone who is diagnosed with CSS has ME in the sort of Ramsey sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is just because the diagnostic criteria are super broad. The ones that we use now and the one that the CDC recommends, it's super broad. And it actually does not include some of the hallmark symptoms. Like the FACUDA definition does not talk about these really severe neurological symptoms
the sensory ones, and the
sound sensitivity and the light sensitivity and the sort of overstimulation. And so when you present with those symptoms, people say, "Oh, okay, well, that's not chronic fatigue syndrome, or you're kind of just crazy." And then when you don't present with those symptoms, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who may have other conditions that are kind of lumped in. And I also think a lot of doctors who aren't really trained in understanding what this is and recognizing it use the name as a shorthand. So you might have like a sleep-wake disorder and be very tired, and that's chronic fatigue. And so it's really kind of a big mess. When I say ME, I don't mean, I'm not really talking about severity. I am showing a lot of, the more severe cases, and I'm not even really exactly sure why. I just find the stories very compelling and important to show.
Well, because, you know, I think it's important that you do that. And, you know, the film is progressing, and I'm sure you'll have other people that...
But I just wanted to say really quickly that the difference between ME and CSS is not severity. Even in these sort of historical outbreaks, you would have people who would get ME, and some people would recover. Some people would be less severely affected. And so it's not about severity. It's about trying to have a clear, very clear definition and theory of what this is. And so actually, as Dr. Enlander was saying before, you know, use the right tests and know how to apply them.
Exactly. And, you know, part of it also is, if you look at, like, my daughter, my oldest daughter actually had mild chronic fatigue syndrome after mono. And I remember going to different doctors, and one of them said, you know, sometimes there's like a 5-year period, and, you know, sometimes you start to see improvement when people get it very young. And she did. And, you know, what I see with my daughter is that she was so sick. I mean, she couldn't pick up her head to drink. I'd have to, you know, give her, I'm only getting nauseous when I'm thinking about it, a drink with a straw. I mean, that's how sick she was. And I think that the reason she's getting better is because the chronic fatigue portion of it is getting better. The fibromyalgia is still very bad. But the chronic fatigue, it just sort of eats at your body. It's horrendous, and I think it's important that you show the whole spectrum of what's going on. And Hillary Johnson I spoke to at the party, and she was saying, you know, people don't understand that kids can get this, teens can get this. And the good news is they're finding that kids that get it seem to have more of a chance of having improvement than others that get it when they're in their 20s or 30s. You know, but it's still devastating. But I want to start talking about the film and Kieran. You know, tell us a little bit about Kieran, who she is, and, you know, how she got involved in this film, Canary in a Coal Mine.
So Kieran Tatonvis is our lovely creative producer, and she, you know, basically I was sort of coming up with this idea to do a film, which I knew that I needed to sort of enlist someone from the beginning. I wanted to do a Kickstarter campaign that would raise enough money to fund our film. And I thought, you know, in order to do that, we really need to show people something that's a very high quality, where we've really gone out and interviewed people and kind of given some, you know, a kind of sampling of, like, here's what we could do if we could go all the way and do a 90-minute film. And so I wanted to find something really good, and I was looking everywhere, and I have no background in film, and I have no sort of networks, and so I just posted this email on the Princeton Alumni Network, and she responded, and we chatted, and I think she was maybe the only person who responded, so I got really lucky. And you know, it was this funny thing where we really hit it off, and she understood the story in a deeply intuitive way, even though she has no personal connection to it. And I don't really know why. I think, you know, a part of it is maybe her own background. She's a rather cosmopolitan person, and I think sort of understands, sort of had a seat for the craft. And she's just been wonderful, and she's been
she's passionate,
really talented.
Yeah.
She's very, very passionate about it.
Very. And this isn't a documentary. This is more of a narrative film. And the people you feature are truly remarkable, the experts that you weave in, I mean, are just incredible. So tell us a little bit about some of the experts. You've mentioned their names before, but, you know, let the listeners know what they're in for with this film, with the experts. And then tell us about Howard. He's incredible. I'm hoping to have him on because I'm going to be doing a series for your film where I'm going to be interviewing a couple of the people that you have on and a couple of the experts. So tell us a little about Howard and Mary and Lisa.
Sure, no problem. Just to clarify, the documentary versus narrative, I mean, basically we're trying to do creative nonfiction, you know, sort of in the literary equivalent, sort of to tell stories about truth and hopefully in a way to kind of move people. We have a really great group of people that we've interviewed so far. So we've interviewed Dr. Enlander, we've interviewed Nancy Klimas, who is an immunologist in Florida. We've interviewed Mady Hornig. We have a lot of other people on our wish list. We really do want to get a wide range of voices of experts who may not necessarily agree with each other on everything, which is, you know, what science is about. It's mm-hmm. messy, and there are debates. We are also interviewing a number of patients. Howard Bloom is a polymath, and he is irrepressible. He's someone who, I mean, he has a huge personality, and he's someone who is, you know, I don't think there are people who can be both into quantum physics and rock stars mm-hmm. in a single lifetime and kind of pull it off. So he's wonderful. And he was bedridden for 15 years, mm-hmm. five of which he could not speak. And today he, like, as he will say to, you know, anyone, like, I can do 490 push-ups. And I mean that's a great story to ask him about how he got from being in that place.
Oh,
where
I
he
plan
is now.
On it, and I plan on talking about him growing up too, because that man is, you know, I have a show on my network about genius, about giftedness, and if there is anyone that fits that category, it is Howard.
Yes, no, for sure, and a very generous person. So we have him. We have. We've done some filming with a woman, Lisa, in Toronto. We weren't able to interview her, unfortunately, remotely, because she can't really speak. And so we're looking forward, if we reach our funding goal, to be able to go and spend time with her and try to tell her story even with those limitations. So we're looking forward to the creative challenges of that. We're also interviewing Jessica, who is amazing. She will tell her own story when she's on, but I think what really I found really compelling about her story was, you know, what you talked about a little bit earlier about how something really awful happens to you, and it actually leads you into finding, you know, a new path or a greater mission. And she's been running this amazing charity called Share a Star from her bed, along with her father, where they raise money and help to sort of give support to children who are dealing with rare or terminal diseases. And so this idea of a woman who can't leave her own bed, helping and giving in that way is just remarkable. But I think it's very natural. When you don't have a lot to give, you want to give that much more in a way, because you understand.
I think you find a purpose. You absolutely find a purpose, you know, in these things. I mean, I see my daughter's only 17 now, and, you know, I see how different she is now from the other kids her age. It just changes you. You know, but go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that I am so much more grateful for every single living, breathing moment of my life. I am hyper aware because there's not a single moment that I do not feel sick. I feel sick constantly.
Yep.
And I'm hyper aware of my body in a way that I never was in my life. You know, my mother used to always say, you know, stay in your body, be aware of your body. I was a mind. I was running around the world to sort of detach my body. And I wish and I hope that through this film we can not only you know, educate people and show the world what the disease looks like, but also bring back some of those lessons that I think we've all learned from being in that place. Because I wish it were possible to see what that is without having to go through this.
And, you know, it shows, I mean, to me, when I left, because like I said, I was shaking when I watched the documentary. And I think that it's powerful because it shows you really, truly what it is and how it affects someone's life. But really, the messages of hope and the anger in these people, which they deserve to be angry, is just incredible, because they've turned that anger and that hopelessness into such something so empowering. You know, and from what I've done on my show, I mean, I do all types of disorders and illnesses for children and teens. But what I found was that whether I was talking about Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, or cancer, the emotions were universal. And that's one thing that you say about this film, that, you know, that you feel it's a universal story.
Well, I did not at first. When this first started happening to me, it felt incredibly individual and like I was having this really idiosyncratic experience that was sort of crazy and outside of normal human life. And then as I started learning more about my illness, I found this really large community of other people living with ME, and that was wonderful. As I started sharing more and more about what I was going through, I started, you know, finding people, you know, old friends who kind of came out of the woodwork with various cases of being, you know, misdiagnosed or poorly treated by doctors. Or I have a friend, Eva Hagberg, who has donated some books to the campaign, and, you know, she was treated for anxiety for years and because she was busy, until doctors, you know, found that she actually has some type of growth in her brain. So it's you start to realize that it's not just about ME, that there are a lot, you know, many sort of broader issues here surrounding chronic illness, how we treat people with chronic illness, how chronic illness affects women in different ways than it affects men. And so I think that there's a universality among sort of people who have this experience of being sick, and being not believed and really having to fight for themselves or go out on their own because of the way the medical system is structured today and the way that doctors are trained. I do hope, and I think we aspire to this in the film, to speak to people whether or not they've had the experience of chronic illness, because I think that at every point someone will face a really difficult moment, or it will happen to someone that they love. It could be health, it could be something else. But they'll face an obstacle that will destroy the vision that they had for their future. And I think that there's a way in which we can crumble in the face of that, or we can try to find a way to make good, whatever that means. And I think that is really the larger story that I want to tell, the larger of human story behind this.
Absolutely. And, you know, you're doing it beautifully. And, you know, as you said the other night, you know, you, with most independent films, you know, you need funding for the film, and most, as most other filmmakers do, you go through Kickstarter. So, you know, basically, how can we help you get this film done? I mean, I cannot tell you how important this film is, not only to me, you know, as a mother of a child going through this, but to all of those, I mean, million people that do not have a voice, you know, who are suffering and are invisible. You know, tell us how you are funding this, because I just want to say that you just had the Kickstarter launch party 2 days ago, and you're already almost at your first goal, which is amazing. So, you know, tell us how you're doing this and how we can help you.
Sure. Well, so we launched around 1 p.m. on Tuesday. It's now Thursday evening, and so we've been live for, I don't know, 53 hours, and we are 80% of the way to our goal. We've raised almost $40,000, and the original goal that we set to raise on Kickstarter was $50,000. The budget for our film is $200,000. We thought, you know, it'll be hard because no one really cares about people with this illness, and so, you know, it's gonna be a hard campaign, but we'll get the money, and if we can get to 50K, we can then go to outside funders and say there's an audience for this story. People want to hear this story, and we wanted people to prove to outside funders that this is a story worth telling and worth their support. And I got it wrong. I got it totally wrong.
Well, tell everybody how Kickstarter works, because you and I know how it works, but it's important people get it.
Yeah, no problem. So Kickstarter is this sort of fundraising platform where people who have creative projects or designing a new product or what have you can come and crowdfund sort of either a prototype or like their project. So for films, it's crowdsourcing the funding to make a film. And it's an all-or-nothing campaign, so if you don't reach your goal, you don't get to keep any of the money that you've raised. And so we set a goal of $50,000, which is a quarter of our budget. And the reason why I set that goal was because I did not want to have to, I knew I didn't have the physical capacity to do what it would take to fund the entire film on Kickstarter. But I think the thing I didn't understand was that raising the money that we needed was not about other people caring about our story. It was about us caring about our own story. And there are a lot of us out there. And we have been just so embraced with love in the last 2 days in ways that I cannot even begin to tell you. And I think people are sort of looking at this film and feeling like we have a voice. And I am trying to raise the entire budget of $200,000 on Kickstarter by November 22nd. And so I need your help to get there. And crowdfunding, you know, the way that it works is you raise money by getting small amounts, small donations from lots and lots of people. So if you've been compelled by the story, if you go to the Kickstarter website and you search for Canary in a Coal Mine, or go to j.mp/canaryfilm, and you feel compelled by the story, please give. And then share. Share it everywhere. Email it to people. Talk about it with your friends. Post it on Facebook or Twitter if you use Facebook and Twitter. And really just get the word out for us. And that would be the best thing that you can do. Because if we could raise our entire budget of $200,000, it would mean so much for this project. Because I am not well, and I cannot go and fundraise in the way that most directors and producers would. And so that's why this platform is so amazing for us, because it allows us to kind of aggregate our voice and say, you know, we care about this. There's a second project which is growing out of this that I wanted to talk about briefly when Marianne, you were talking about voicelessness. I have received so many stories from people, and it's every time I open my email, I'm either crying with gratitude or my heart is breaking. People who send me photos of themselves in the emergency room, people who are, you know, fighting because the state is trying to take away their children because their children have ME and the doctors don't know what that is, and so they don't believe them. And,
right.
And it's just a lot of really powerful things happening. And so what we've decided to do is start this website to allow people to share their own stories and to post videos and photos and text, because I think this Kickstarter campaign, I mean, it would be lovely to raise the money that we need for the film, but I think that there's a larger moment happening here where even if we're sick and weak and at home in our beds, if we can all sort of speak and shout with one voice, it's going to be, I really think we can change the world. And whenever I say that, I know it sounds a little crazy, but I think it's already starting to happen. And so please share the project and
it
please
absolutely
share your story.
Is. And I just want to just be clear to our listeners that, you know, even though you did set the goal much lower than you needed for this film, and people are just responding like crazy, if you don't get the $50,000, you don't get to keep the $40,000. And by the way, I'm online right now watching, and in the past 10 minutes that you've been talking, you got 3 more donations, which is awesome. I'm just watching the numbers roll here. But, you know, keep in mind that if you feel for this film, if you think that you would like to contribute, and when you go on, if you go to Kickstarter, just type in Canary in a Coal Mine in the search, and it'll come up. And they've got some really cool packages where you can give $1, you can give, you know, $400. You know, they have different things that you can get, like signed photos and hoodies, and, you know, you can, Howard Bloom is even giving away a 10-minute one-on-one conversation. So, you know, there are a lot of great things to do. So please go to Kickstarter, type in Canary in a Coal Mine, and give what you can. And when we have this website up, we'll put it up. It's on our website at thecoffeeclatch.com. You can go to the blog, and everything is there. You can watch the trailer, which is incredible. You can go to the website, Canary in a Coal Mine. It's www.canaryinacoalminefilm.com. And you can watch the trailer there, and you can watch Jennifer and Kieran talk about the project. And, you know, I'm just so thrilled to be even a little part of, you know, helping you get this out.
Thank you so much, Marianne, for all of your support. This has been wonderful.
Well, it's great. And like I said, I apologize to Jessica Taylor, who we were trying to get on by Skype. I don't know what happened. But I'm going to be interviewing the author of Osler's Web, Hillary Johnson, and I'm going to be bringing Jessica on for that interview. And I hope to have a few more people and do a series on this amazing film. So the best of luck to you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely
You're
evening.
Welcome. As I end each show, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent with us at The Coffee Clatch. You can find us at www.thecoffeeclatch.com. Have a great night, everyone.